Hello,
I'm Jessica Marquardt, and this is Kaleidoscope, the Cortical Visual Impairment Podcast. There's a growing public health crisis that no one is talking about. Cortical visual impairment, CVI. It's the leading cause of pediatric visual impairment in the United States and the developed world, and becoming more prevalent as neonatal care improves and the number of children surviving brain injury increases. My daughter has CVI. CVI is a brain-based visual impairment rather than ocular. People with CVI can see, but they have trouble processing what they see. What's it like to live with CVI? Dr. Christine Roman, author of the book Cortical Visual Impairment, An Approach to Assessment and Intervention, has said that it could be characterized as looking through a kaleidoscope of color and light. Hence, the name of our show. It must be disorienting and frustrating to view the world through a kaleidoscope, but it doesn't have to be that way forever. Why? In a word, neuroplasticity. With intentional intervention to build connections in the brain, people with CVI can improve their vision. You heard me right. Vision can improve. And the earlier, the better. We'll get into the details as we travel on this podcast journey together. We're going to start with stories told by parents and caregivers about their child's life with CVI. There are moments of pain, moments of inspiration, but there's always hope. Hope, because if we intervene correctly, and we'll get into how to do that, we should expect positive change in our child's vision. We're also hoping and fighting for positive change in the arenas of medicine, education, and policy, so that all kids with CVI have an early chance to regain vision. I recently found out that I'm not alone. My family's not alone. There are other parents out there who are fierce advocates for their children with CVI. It takes a ton of hard work to get our children what they need to access their world. Children with cortical visual impairment have a right to visual access and educational and social inclusion. Advocating for that right often feels like a wilderness. For too long, our children with CVI have been denied equal access to appropriate assessments, interventions, and services. They deserve better. There's a nationwide lack of awareness of CVI. Our children have a right to providers who are aware, educated, and knowledgeable about CVI. Parents struggle to get a CVI diagnosis for their child, to find educational teams who know CVI, to find vision teachers who are educated and trained in best practices in CVI. Most professionals in the fields of medicine, ophthalmology, early intervention, and education are completely unprepared to address the issues that CVI families are facing. Our intent here is to make it feel a little less like the wilderness. It'll still be challenging, but there are people in this with you. Today's guest is Dan Marquardt. He's from Raleigh, North Carolina. He runs his own commercial real estate business, and his daughter, Grace, is 6 years old and in kindergarten. She has CVI, and Grace is currently in phase two CVI, according to Dr. Roman's CVI range. And by the way, if you haven't figured it out already, he's also my husband and partner in advocacy. So welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Jessica.
Yeah, in your own closet.
Well, it's kind of unique.
You want to tell everybody where we are?
We are deep into our master bedroom's walk-in closet to drown out all the noise and provide for good sound absorption. So it's
definitely the strangest date location we've ever had, I think.
And unfortunately, most of our dates are centered around CVI these days.
Well, it's true. Do you want to tell everybody about our advocacy dates?
Well, there's been quite a few. And, you know, even though they're draining, they are quite rewarding because they add insight into our daughter and one of the most important things in our lives.
So, well, what did we do on Valentine's Day?
Really?
You don't remember? Well, we met with a disability advocate, someone who runs a local organization, and he spent 2 hours with us that morning. And then as a result, we got to go to lunch afterwards because it was lunchtime. So we stole a date out of that moment.
True.
And then with the 30 plus IEP meeting hours that we endured transitioning Grace to kindergarten, we had a very specific routine. Pedicures. We'd go to the IEP meeting and then we'd go get a pedicure.
Yeah, as far as all of our dates go around CVI. Yeah, true. So we did try to wind something into there that made it bearable, but we would always end up talking about our next steps.
Yeah, well, it's important to have an opportunity to debrief on what happened and then try to relax. So when you tell someone that Grace has cortical visual impairment, what sort of reaction do you usually get?
Sort of this kind of confused look. So I tend to say she's visually impaired and it's brain-based versus using the CVI terminology.
Yeah, it always needs that caveat. But I kind of don't agree with that. I feel like we should say cortical visual impairment and get those words out there more frequently.
I do. But the first time that I ever see one or see someone or talking about it, I make it very simple.
Yeah.
And I try to even have Grace advocate for herself when someone or a little kid asks about her cane, that she is able to voice it, that she uses it to maneuver around and without tripping and falling. And it's because she can't see as well as others because she has a boo-boo on her brain.
Yeah. Did you coach her to say that? Because I've noticed she's really become a good self-advocate, and it's not like we fed her the words.
No, I did actually feed her those words a couple times.
Sneaky.
When she was younger and starting to go onto the playgrounds and stuff. I think one of the first times I can remember was in Greensboro or someplace. We stopped off at a mall. You went in to get some clothes for the kids, and I was playing with them out on the little playground outside the mall. And
that was your first recollection of coaching her to be like that?
First time that I've heard her say it herself to someone.
Right. Yeah. To speak up.
Right.
I've heard her do it on a number of occasions, and it always floors me. We were in a music class, and she and the teacher had the kids seated in a circle around the carpet, and she was going to lead as a member of the circle, and Grace was on the far side, and she spoke up right away and said, I can't really see as well. I really need to sit next to you. And so then the teacher, I mean, who did not know about her CVI, invited her to come up closer. And to your point about her cane, she does a nice job of describing how it helps her, and she'll walk up to a child who's asked about what it does and knock their feet. And she said, this is so I will know not to step on you.
As of late, though, especially like last night, I had a date night with the girls, and Grace was resisting the cane tremendously. But it's in a very known environment that we go two or three times a week for dinner. And she just was adamant not to use it, saying that she has to think more than other kids when she walks or whatever. It makes her think more, and she doesn't want to think more.
Yeah, well, she does enough of that just to get through the world, so I hear her. I think we should go back to the beginning, though, before Grace was even diagnosed. Can you talk about the early days, you know, the first few months of Grace's life, or what you remember of it?
I remember thinking, this baby seems more difficult than what I thought it would be.
And with her being our first, we didn't really have a benchmark.
Right. Didn't have a benchmark. But just the lack of feeding, she was never really sleeping well. And
she wasn't eating, and we taped a little SNS tube on our pinky fingers and let her suck on that to just take the tiniest amount of milk. And she was low birth weight, so she was 4 pounds, 9 ounces when she was born, and we really needed her to gain weight, and she was losing weight. It's very scary.
When you look at mom and dad, you and I, we're not the smallest of people, so that 10th percentile baby that was slipping on the growth charts was of concern, you know, during the early days. But I guess it goes back to, we just didn't know, you know, and she wasn't making a lot of milestones, and so.
Yeah. And then she was hospitalized really early on. maybe 2 months old.
Probably for dehydration, lack of fluids, but which resulted in a UTI.
It was our first real taste of many ER trips to come, but very, very scary. Do you want to tell everybody about Grace's diagnosis, how we got her diagnosis, and what it was?
We had sort of been dealing with a small baby for first couple months, and I think then your mother passed away in a bicycle accident, and that kind of threw us for a little tailspin for a few more months. And what's interesting is that my father is an ophthalmologist, my brother's an optometrist, my mom is a former nurse, and your father's a MD, gynecologist.
Oh, you really stuttered over that word. Did it make you nervous? Did it make it nervous to say that?
I wanted to say gyno. you know, a lot of experience within our family in the medical world. And I remember it was after a trip to Ohio that my father said, you know, I think you guys need to take that little girl up to Duke and have her eyes looked at. She's not tracking. And by that time, we weren't really meeting a lot of milestones. I think my father and mom saw it earlier, you know, in the first couple months of meeting Grace. And but then with your mother's passing, you know, gave us a little time to adjust. I almost wish that wasn't the case and that that they would have just told us.
But we might not have been ready to hear it at all. And we didn't have any benchmarks, like we mentioned before. We didn't really know.
But it so it's great to actually have someone that put us on that track and set up the appointments even and got us in and done quickly and saw Ed Buckley up there at Duke. And, you know, he sent us for some MRIs and came back with all these diagnoses. The main one that was number one on the list was optic nerve hypoplasia. And basically there is nothing you can do about that.
He said, wait and watch.
And that really, I think at that point, our ears just kind of turned off. And
it was just a lot of technical
CDI
medical terms.
Was number four on the list and didn't really address it. And that's how we got our diagnosis.
What would you say your reaction was when we walked out of the office with the ophthalmologist? And
I don't know. I think it was a shock, but also, oh, that explains it. And I want to say it was shortly thereafter that, you know, I woke up one day thinking this baby is not growing like she needs to be. She's not meeting her milestones. And I think it's because of her nutrition. I actually had like a nightmare that I woke up from that basically I just had it in my head that she had to get a feeding tube and to get nutrients into her because she eating was just not happening, quite frankly. And we were trying a whole bunch of different things, and when you really added up the calories, it wasn't enough.
Why do you think you're so in tune?
Because I eat way too much and drink way too much. And
so it was just very weird to have this grazing, not hungry child. I mean, she never exhibited signs of hunger at all. And I know that a lot of other children with cortical visual impairment have feeding difficulties, feeding tubes, just from people that I've talked to. And I guess it's just par for the course with it. Kind of want to know what the mechanism is, though. Love to talk to someone about that.
Yeah. The growth chart, though, looked like a hockey stick after that. Once we got the feeding tube and she started to hit a lot more of her milestones. I think around that same time, we were struggling with the daycare, being able to really properly look after her, and we had a lot of different therapies and stuff going on.
Yeah, we had PT, speech, OT. We had a teacher of the visually impaired coming to our home through early intervention, and feeding therapy.
Mm-hmm. So that was definitely a whirlwind of activity that got engaged. I want to say once we had the diagnosis, then we
which I'd like to back up. A diagnosis that we did not fully understand.
Yeah.
Nor did we even really hear CVI We heard optic nerve hypoplasia, a bunch of other things, and but then didn't even hear CBI.
But it was on the list. And, you know, so to that regard, I mean, we could have gone and looked up more and inquired more, but you're so just trying to survive at that point that it'd be nice that if the doctor spent that extra 5 minutes giving you a couple handouts and resources or had a nurse that, you know, would talk to you another day, or, you know, you could call back and
after
get a little
soaked in
after it's soaked in, after you're over that initial trauma and or jolt.
Well, and that's all assuming that the ophthalmologist gets CVI. They do eyes,
right?
Not brains.
And I think Grace's CVI diagnosis was because of the MRI that they did and what that showed. I don't think that he would have diagnosed CVI had they not done that MRI.
Right. And so then think about all the other kids who don't even have a CVI diagnosis. And I know Dr. Broman has told us so many times, you know, there are three criteria for diagnosis, and CVI is best identified with a normal eye exam, an eye exam that reveals an eye condition that does not explain the lack of functional vision, and a medical history that includes neurological problems and the presence of unique visual and behavioral characteristics. So that's my PSA. And for those of you listening who don't know what the unique visual and behavioral characteristics are, I'll list them out quickly. But as you continue to listen to other people's journeys on this podcast, you'll become more acquainted with them as they describe their children, and probably you'll start to recognize some very similar things. So there's color preference, attention to light, attraction to movement, visual latency, preferred visual field, difficulties with visual and environmental complexity, difficulty with distance viewing, absent or atypical visual reflexes, difficulty with visual novelty, and absence of visually guided reach. So I think you were talking about how we had Grace in a daycare setting, but having to manage the feeding tube and all of the therapies was becoming difficult. They did a great job. I mean, they learned how to use the feeding tube.
Yeah, no, they really did. And
but we had to move on to something that would accommodate her better.
And when we got our diagnosis was about the same time that you were pregnant with our second, Liz. Or we found
did
out.
That, we did that on purpose.
Oh, did we? Only one of us knew then.
We had them so close together. Our daughters are 16 months apart, and it's a tremendous blessing. As also, we were just in the trenches for a very long time. Grace was getting up 10 times a night. I mean, that's not even an exaggeration, 10 times a night. And until we had Liz, when Grace was about 16 months, even then, Grace was getting up multiple times, and Liz was getting up several times to feed. And then I have this memory of our bedtime routine. I would snuggle with Grace in her rocking chair and read a story and then set her up with the overnight feed. I would do that while she was kind of starting to relax and conk out. And we had cut slits in all of her onesies to accommodate the tube coming out. So we'd set it all up, tape the tube to her leg a bit so that she didn't get wrapped up in it. And then came the real challenge. I had to get up out of the rocking chair holding a baby attached to a feeding tube with my pregnant belly protruding out. It was so much energy and force just to get up out of the rocking chair. And then once I got up, I had to make it across the bedroom carrying the baby, my belly, and the pole where the feeding tube was attached, and then try to carefully lay her into the bed without disturbing her. It's funny now, but it wasn't then. The things we do. So we hired a nanny, and we knew she was the right one right away.
Well, it was a process. We started multiple different avenues of looking for one. But like you said, we knew right away, basically because we were starting a tube feed when she came in the door to interview. She immediately, you know, knew what was going on, inquired about when we went to flush it, how much water we were using to flush out the tube with.
Yeah, she said, so how many cc's do you use for the flush? 20? 30? We were like, you're hired.
She had had prior experience with feeding tubes and a special needs child. So, and was a very loving and caring part of our family for about 2 years. And I think, like Jessica told me once, that we've had sort of these divine meetings or people come into our lives.
Divine appointments. People who come into your life who were just meant to be there to help you through that stage, or maybe it's just that moment, or maybe they say something to you or give you a resource that you remember later that you need critically at that point. And I mean, the nanny fits into that bucket for sure. And she was able to attend all the therapies that Grace was doing and then reinforce so that she was able to move a little more quickly. And I guess I just wish I had known at that point that Grace's vision could improve with intentional
interventions
based on a CVI range score. We had no idea. So we had early intervention services, and then Grace transitioned to preschool at our state school for the blind and visually impaired. And the nice thing about that is that there were so few kids in there. She got a lot of attention. They went on a field trip every week. So those experiences were really important. But we definitely didn't hear about CVI from any of the professionals who we interacted with.
And most of the modifications weren't necessarily centered around or accommodated CVI. So she really wasn't getting that appropriate access to her schooling and education.
What would you say was our turning point, our aha moment, to start thinking about CVI and its implications for Grace?
My father wanted us to have Grace evaluated at Bascom Palmer Eye Institute in Miami, specifically around the retina. And so when we were down in South Florida visiting my parents, we went to that appointment. And from that diagnosis, or from that meeting with, funny enough, a doctor named Dr. Grace was the student in doing
she was the fellow, I think,
doing the fellowship there. And who has since moved to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which we're thankful for. That sort of put CVI on our radar.
Well, I remember them saying, look how she's getting around the room. We were in the clinic in the exam room, and they had taken pictures of her eye and her optic nerve. And they were thinking, it might not be optic nerve hypoplasia.
It's more like optic nerve atrophy.
And the way she's getting around, it just seems like, have you ever thought that maybe CVI is the main reason she's having visual difficulty?
And so then we pulled up the records from Duke, and sure enough, CVI was 4 on the list. And they said there's stuff you can do for that, you know, or they kind of
alluded to
do some research and look into this and that. So we started Googling more.
Well, you started Googling. I give you all the credit. You really know how to use Google, Dan.
Yep. Siri's, you know, second runner up.
Yeah. So after that second opinion, and we started to do some research on CVI.
There was a CVI, Pediatric Cortical Visual Impairment Society conference that was like 2 or 3 weeks away in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places. So I remember thinking that, geez, I have so much going on. I don't know if I can make it out there. And Jessica didn't really...
Well, you invited me, and
I wasn't able to fit it into her schedule.
No, I said no. I had no faith.
Yeah.
And I just appreciate that you were so willing to be flexible and go out on a limb to reach after new avenues and new research and new ideas that I wasn't open to hearing at that point. I stayed home with the kids, and I went out
there with my father. Great conference that opened up my eyes to cortical visual impairment, and especially, you know, started reading Dr. Roman's book. We had ordered a couple copies of that before we went out. Then, you know, things started to sort of make sense. You know, kind of see this is sort of Grace, and we also were going through the thought process of Braille or no Braille, and you know, why does she need to learn Braille? Was sort of one of the, you know, sort of that early stage of
understanding how she's going to access the world, access literacy. And we later found out that Braille is completely inappropriate for a child with CVI. But it took us a year after that to fight to have the Braille taken out. But I would say the next step, I mean, after you left that conference, we started to educate ourselves, and then we traveled to see Dr. Roman to have Grace's first CVI range done.
So I think that it was really beneficial to get up to see Dr. Roman, have that range done, understand everything that was going on a little bit better and what interventions we could do. And that there was a guideline of, hey, this is, you know, sort of where she is. And these are the things that you can do to help in all these different categories and go at it. And it's throughout the day. It's not just an hour of intervention. It needs to be infused throughout the day and take those small opportunities that will create new pathways.
We read stacks of books.
Well, you did.
I know you don't love to read, but we watched webcasts, and Perkins is just doing such a great job educating people on CVI in a way that other organizations aren't. So we found a lot of value in what they're putting out there. And we went back to our school and we started to ask more informed questions. Like, what should we be doing to intervene appropriately with the characteristics of CVI in mind? And what's your CVI roadmap? Who do you have on staff who's capable? And what we found out is that they just don't teach it in schools and training programs. And so a lot of teachers just are not equipped
and didn't know how to administer the CVI range. We ended up hiring various consultants and flew them down to North Carolina to meet Grace and to help us come up with our strategies and our plans, start our interventions. We learned a lot and read the books, and that kicked off our...
Specifically, Dr. Broman's book, Cortical Visual Impairment.
Yes, the book.
An approach like to assessment, an intervention.
The Bible, and there is the book.
Well, it is literally the only framework.
No, there's a second edition now.
Right.
And hopefully a new book coming out. So, but I think that first time that I went to Omaha for the Pediatric Cortical Visual Impairment Society conference, that started our due diligence, really, into CVI and what we could do to help Grace. And as we mentioned earlier, you read a lot of books about neuroplasticity around and got educated.
As well as some popular science books, basic books about the brain, just trying, you know, casting the net wide and seeing what we could learn that would be helpful.
And so the next year you learned a lot. And I think that was like a eye-opening weekend for you of like, oh my God, look at these kids that are out there reading.
On grade level
or above grade level. And we heard the story from Marianne Roberto and Gungeon of what can happen when things are done right, when things are caught early and appropriate interventions are in place, centered around a known range and being able to do the right interventions.
Yeah, hearing that story of what goes right and how they caught this young child in early intervention and then helped him to improve his functional vision by doing all the right things. I mean, I had tears streaming down my face.
Why did you have tears?
Such a beautiful, beautiful story, but I mean, we missed...
Did you have tears because you're upset that maybe we missed those first 4 or 5 years?
Absolutely. That conference was so hard for me. It was overwhelming. I was learning so much. I didn't have a network of people who I had the chance to speak with and in person and hear their stories and know that there was hope. I didn't know any of that. And then when I did know it, my wheels were turning. I'm like, well, what are we going to do?
And I think then goes our advocacy into getting the FAPE, or free and appropriate public education, for our daughter. Basically, I remember in one of the 30 to 60 hours of IEP meetings, someone saying, you know, we basically needed on record that you're refusing Braille so that when she comes around to third grade and she's behind, then, you know, we can kind of say, we told you so. That really just, you know, they were doing more of this CYA than saying, hey, you know what, with the appropriate interventions, it's expected, known that she will improve and that she will be able to read. It was very disheartening. It really laid out the path of a lot of resistance and but I think there was a lot of lack of knowledge on CVI within our community. We definitely had to help, and we really wanted to help educate folks even offered to pay for courses, Perkins courses for teachers that wanted to take it. And we got denied through the school system saying that they couldn't accept gifts. That kind of lit a fire underneath me. Oh, if I wanted to donate a stadium or a scoreboard, they would let me know within probably about 20 minutes to an hour how to get that done. This took them 8 months to come back around and finally say, you know, no, really, we just can't take gifts.
Well, and another frustration was once they did come around to providing training in CVI, no one could guarantee that a member or all of Grace's team would be in attendance because it was happening over the summer and they can't mandate that someone take a training over the summer, which didn't make any sense to me at all, just because she needs someone with that knowledge. So why not provide someone with that knowledge no matter what it takes?
The other aspect of doing a CVI range assessment is so that you can know where to do your interventions. Sort of one of my sticking points is that someone that is working with your child or the TVI that's in charge of your child's case should be able to administer the range and be able to see when something is getting resolved and know when certain aspects of certain modifications need to be changed up because they're progressing on the range, and know when to say, hey, it's time to do another range assessment. It's almost like, how can you teach someone if you can't even give them the test at the end of it or at the beginning of it?
How you wouldn't have someone teaching a child Braille who did not know
Braille.
Braille.
Yeah. No one's within our system is standing behind like the CVI range, but yet they might stand behind ABA therapy for autistic kids. Why can't they? I don't understand some of the
reasoning
behind various
decisions,
procedural or policy mm-hmm. level decisions, mm-hmm. especially when we've seen such great results. And we're doing the right interventions.
I think that one of the most exciting things was when we hired a CVI range endorsed TVI to come down to visit Grace, get an understanding of how she was using her functional vision to do a CVI range as a starting point, and then to help us build specific interventions for her to do over the summer. And that CVI range endorsed person then mentored our private occupational therapist, who's actually local. The range endorsed person lived in a different state, but would consult with us by phone or FaceTime. So our local OT, she started to become educated. And we offered, hey, take this course at Perkins. And she said, oh, yes, please. She said, yes. She said, said it right away. And I had never experienced enthusiasm like that before. You know, someone who would just say, yes, I'm willing to learn something new because I want to help this kid. I want to help other kids. And so I think that setup over the summer where we had our OT visiting Grace every day in her daycare setting, using CVI specific interventions under the guidance and mentorship of a CVI range endorsed person. And then
it wasn't only just a CVI range endorsed person. It was someone that had proven themselves with doing appropriate interventions. Just because you can do the score someone on the range doesn't mean that you can necessarily do the right modifications and provide the appropriate access and interventions for mm-hmm. that child. I think that there needs to be a little gap there. Yeah, there's a little gap, you know, and became evident to me the further I got into learning about the endorsements and everything else. Mm-hmm.
But it worked really well in our case, and we started to introduce much more salient feature language. We created story boxes for some of her favorite books so that she could look at real 3D objects of things that she was hearing about in stories. She just started to use her vision on a completely different level. And then when we went back to do the range, 3 months after starting that program, she had moved a quarter of a point in that quarter of a year, which is on par with the research that says that, you know, if you're doing the right things, you would expect about a point gain in a year. So that was really worth celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we did.
No, I think we then got into, more IEP meetings, trying to figure out where what her day-to-day life would look like as a kindergartner.
Well, what does her day-to-day look like as a kindergartner?
That's a great question. We should ask her.
Well, she wants to be a teacher, and she comes home and she plays school, and I'm pretty sure that she just repeats many of the things that she hears adults say at school. So we get a fairly good sense of what happens. But she is in her neighborhood school in a gen ed classroom, and she spends 2 hours a day with her teacher of the visually impaired.
Which, in order to get her into her least restrictive environment, was even just a battle in itself to be placed at our base school.
Well, maybe we should do a part two.
Okay.
What's something that has surprised you the most about Grace?
The actual improvement in vision. The other night she read a story to you that she's writing and doing all these things that I really never thought that she would be doing.
I completely agree. And I have this worry constantly that I think, oh my gosh, how is she ever going to learn to read? Then she will turn around and say, hey mom, can we write a book? I'm like, oh, you're going to be okay. What do you think is the most courageous thing that we've had to do as parents in our journey so far?
Is this barring all the hospital visits and all the testing and stuff like that?
I don't know. What do you think? Maybe it's an unfair question.
I remember we had feeding tube in and she had some complications with that. So we were running a dye test on her and she was strapped to a board. Hands up above her head, feet down the leg, filled her stomach up with the dye, and then you rotate her like a pig on a
spit.
so that the fluids were going down to the bottom of the stomach. You weren't in the room, and you know, taking pictures of that and stuff to, just weird things like that that were kind of heartbreaking, but you knew you just had to like get them done. And I think the whole journey has been interesting, from the early days of, getting the diagnosis to just trying to survive and then realizing, oh, we could have done so much more if we would have known. Where would we have been had someone just knew what the hell to do and advised us and done the right thing for Grace? And, in the grand scheme of things, it all will work out. It's not going to be as easy as everyone else. With typically developing kids, but with technology and Grace's drive, I think we just need to try to make her a productive member of society, which I think she can easily be.
Happy and resilient.
Yeah. And part of it is that we're just so worn out, I think recently from, I think it comes down to worn out from trying to be advocates and having to fight for what Grace needs. And it's unfortunate that so much time and energy and money has to be spent there. I wish that it could be easier and that the policy level and the admin level of the education system was more on board. I think the boots on the ground really want to know and really want to help. But I think when you get up into the levels of, sort of running a business, some of these children get left behind.
Do you ever feel a sense of loss or grief over what you thought was going to be your normal?
Yeah, sure, I guess. But, you embrace the new normal and, you look at it from a perspective of, there are things that we're doing advocacy-wise that are going to help a lot of other kids. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's our actual purpose of being here.
No one would ever wish that their child had a disability, and certainly not one that was so poorly understood that it was hard to find support and resources, as is the case. But the flip side is that so many of Grace's strengths almost come as a result of some of her deficits. And she's just this special special person who I can't imagine in any other way. And then I view just about everything she does as a miracle. Like, little miracles happen in our house anytime she's around.
Yeah.
Deep breath. Was there anything else that you'd want to say?
Well, I think being on a weekly advocacy call or parent group call has been very helpful. And having other friends that have children with special needs and a lot more complex needs than Grace's, or maybe not complex, but more severe, you know, and so my heart really kind of goes out to all those folks that have not only just CVI, but multiple issues that they're dealing with. In some ways, feel very blessed, and that gives me energy to be more of an advocate so that as we get the right things in place for Grace and hopefully affect more of a policy level, that it helps all these other kids and their parents can see some of the fruits of our labor and help ease their struggles, because mm-hmm. they are probably dealing with much more than we are.
Well said. Dream big, baby. Thank you.
Thanks.
You may exit the closet. I'm going to go pick up the kids.
All right.
Love you.
Bye.
Sitting in a closet for this interview with my husband is kind of a metaphor for us. In so many ways, we have all the support we need. We spoke earlier of divined appointments, and there have been many beyond the nanny. Enough for another episode. But in many ways, Dan and I feel isolated. There are only two of us in this world who know what it's like to be Grace's parents. And when nothing about your experience with your child is textbook, it takes a toll. Of course, there is one textbook that describes our daughter in a way that no one else has. That's Cortical Visual Impairment, An Approach to Assessment and Intervention by Dr. Christine Roman. If you haven't read it, do. You can buy it through AFB, or borrow it from your state school for the blind, or your teacher of the visually impaired. If they don't have it, that should set off some signals for you that your school system has some learning to do. In the coming months, we'll hear from other parents about their CVI journeys. Each child is unique, and each parent has had to roguely cut a path for their unique circumstances. But we do have a shared experience and a new community. Thank you for listening to our story. I hope you'll continue to listen to Kaleidoscope, the Cortical Visual Impairment podcast. Please subscribe to be sure you hear them all. If your child has CVI and you'd like to join forces with a group of fierce, empowered, passionate advocates,
please find Start Seeing CVI Advocacy on Facebook.
Thanks, y'all.